The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. This week, we're looking at psychedelics. The National Institutes of Health is holding a psilocybin research speaker series. One of the speakers at the June 4th lecture was Peter Hendricks, Ph.D. He's a professor and director of research in the Department of Health Behavior at the School of Public Health of the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Professor Hendricks spoke on the topic of special considerations for evaluating psilocybin-facilitated treatments in vulnerable populations.
Abraham Maslow, who was very interested in transcendent peak experiences, as he called them, would have said, look, this is a theory of motivation. Right? What are humans motivated to seek? And he would say, first, some basic physical needs, food, water, shelter, followed by social needs. And though in his initial model, he placed self-actualization at the top of this pyramid, he later amended this and thought at the very top of this pyramid, once essentially everything's been taken care of and accounted for, what humans ultimately seek is something that's self-transcendent, something that transcends who we are. So I think the psychedelic experience for many people might lie at the top of this pyramid. In other words, it's something of a luxury that one might seek after a number of other very important needs are taken care of. In other words, the Black Panthers who were approached by Abbie Hoffman were answering in a very authentic and accurate way. This isn't something they had the luxury to pursue. And I think this idea is borne out in the epidemiological data. Here, if you can see, the numbers might be quite small. But here you can see in a study that we conducted just a little while back with the National Survey on Drug Use and Health gives us some sense of what the average classic psychedelic user might look like in the United States. And I draw your attention to the breakdown by gender, by race, and education, and income. And generally what you see is that psychedelic users trend male and white with a bit more education and income than those who have not used psychedelics. So I think historically and even today, generally speaking, classic psychedelics are substances that you might say are favored by those with more privilege, by white men with education and income. And it would appear that the interest in psychedelics, both among researchers and participants, reflects these population trends. And there have been a number of very thoughtful pieces recently. Here is a recent piece that was co-authored by my friend Al Garcia. And in this piece and in others, it has been noted that in contemporary clinical trials of psychedelics, more than 80% of the participants are white. Now, you might note that that generally reflects the population of those who have ever used classic psychedelics, but it's certainly not representative of the United States as a whole. There are also some questions around socioeconomic status. As we know, race is confounded with income. And there are also some concerns about the time-intensive nature of psychedelic treatments. So they often include a number of preparation sessions, a day-long drug administration session, and then a number of integration sessions. And this time-intensive nature of the treatments may mean that they're especially accessible to those who have resources, who have time, who are able to take time off of work, who can devote time to a study without reimbursement. Well, we don't know this. This hasn't been studied systematically, but there are some concerns in that regard. And therefore, what we're concerned about here is that individuals who are from vulnerable populations have been systematically excluded from this research. And this is This is problematic because increasingly a number of mental health conditions are concentrated among vulnerable populations. And this is certainly the case with regard to addiction. Increasingly, people with smoke, people with alcohol use disorder, or other substance use disorders are increasingly lower income, less education, are racial and ethnic minorities, and individuals with chronic health conditions. So we do need to be aware that our clinical trials may not be quite hitting the mark in terms of recruiting representative participants. And when I talk about vulnerable populations, there are many that we might list, and here are just a few. Racial or ethnic minorities, those who are economically disadvantaged, LGBTQ individuals, people living with HIV or other chronic health conditions, people in the criminal justice system, which is a population near and dear to my heart, one that I'll talk about a bit later in this presentation. And here now I have, I think, some guiding principles that draw in part on this construct of cultural humility that I think could be helpful to the field going forward. So, the first is that learning never ends, right? What we're doing now is laying the foundation that needs further development, but the learning that we do never ends. So we're in a constant state of self-evaluation and critique. What that means is we should always ask ourselves, how can we improve? What can we be doing better? What can we be doing better to serve vulnerable populations? And I think, as many people have noted, I'm certainly not the first to indicate this. There appears to be the need for greater inclusivity and diversity in the research community. How we accomplish that, I can't say. I certainly think community-based participatory research could be one avenue. I certainly think we could make efforts to include women and people of color as part of the psychedelic research community. Though I think one thing we have to look to, and one thing that could ultimately prove to be a rather tricky blind spot, is that many of us, by virtue of our backgrounds, our training and qualifications, would be quite educated and quite affluent, at least relative to many of the vulnerable populations we might be interested in serving. So I think this issue will likely require some creative solutions and some attempts to ensure that we have some representation from the populations we intend to serve in our own research labs. I think we also need to think hard about improving access to this treatment. So, note again that in many of the studies we've seen so far, the objective has been to establish efficacy, right? And not yet have we really considered how these treatment models might look in the real world. But many of us would acknowledge even now that a number of the current models may not translate very well, may not be scalable, that intensive treatments may not be accessible to a number of vulnerable populations. And we have to consider that the people we hope to reach have challenging lives, have demanding jobs and other demands that might make coming to appointments for long periods of time or on a regular basis a challenge. One thing I've noted in the work that I do is that for many people who might participate in a trial like my own, life can be quite chaotic. Of no fault of their own, life is quite chaotic. And that requires those of us who do this research to be quite flexible and allow for cancellations and rescheduling and seeing our participants outside of normal work hours and at times, conducting assessments outside of traditional academic settings. In other words, trying our best to meet our participants or patients halfway. I think we also have to evaluate our recruitment methods and, whether our recruitment methods are effective in reaching the populations we hope to reach. That's something that we've experimented with here through trial and error and have found some effective means of reaching the populations we want to reach. But I mean, things that should be considered would be obviously if you're posting flyers and which neighborhoods are these flyers being posted. If you are trying to connect with community gatekeepers, who are those gatekeepers? With whom do they work? And if you're posting advertisements, you might also consider the readership of these advertisements. But I think we have to think hard and make our very best attempt to recruit from these populations that might otherwise be difficult to reach. The next guiding principle that I think could be very helpful is to have historical awareness. Right? So we have to be aware of the history of exploitation and distrust of the scientific enterprise among vulnerable populations. You know, it's very often the case that scientists swoop in almost like aliens from another planet, and they collect the data they need or want, and then they disappear back to their home planet with the populations they're working with wondering what happened. And I think we need to do a better job collaborating and doing everything we can to avoid repeating the mistakes of the past. And I'm not just talking about highly unethical research studies like the Tuskegee experiment, but I'm also talking about building greater trust and rapport with our partners in the community and work collaboratively so that there is not the impression that anyone is being exploited by scientists, but that we are trying to work cooperatively and hand in hand for everyone's benefit. I think we also have to be aware of the potential stigma that might be associated with psychedelics, you know, that these might be considered the drug of choice of so-called hippies or the countercultural Woodstock generation, that these might be the drugs of the chosen few or pie in the sky white liberals, whatever it might be. I think we have to work hard to address these stigmas and communicate in a very transparent manner what we think psychedelics might do, how we think they could change mental health treatment, and be as transparent as we possibly can be about our own awareness of these associations and stigmas, and note that our objective, of course, is to improve the nature of mental health treatment.
That was Peter Hendricks, PhD, a professor and director of research in the Department of Health Behavior at the School of Public Health at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Professor Hendricks spoke recently on the topic of special considerations for evaluating psilocybin-facilitated treatments in vulnerable populations as part of the National Institutes of Health's Psilocybin Research Speaker Series. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The UK nonprofit Drug Science is holding a speaker series entitled Women in Psychedelic Science. One of the speakers at the June 2nd lecture was Yasmin Piracek. She's a consultant with a master's degree in biology focusing on boreal forest ethnobotany, and she's a student of Maestro Juan Flores, a plant medicine teacher of the Peruvian Amazon. She spoke on the topic of developing a traditional medicine strategy for the diabetes epidemic in First Nations communities.
Thanks for having me. I'm very excited to be here. I'd just like to share the teachings because rarely do we get to share many of the traditional perspectives here in Canada. So in my work, what I've seen with many of my family members and many Indigenous community members in Canada is that many traumas, and the reason why we use psychedelics is because it's so effective for trauma, which many of the panelists have spoken about. But trauma, we know that trauma leads to chronic illness. And this is exemplified by the adverse childhood experience studies done by sociology researchers. That many of these traumas, and especially the traumas that are experienced by Indigenous peoples in Canada, many of the traumas could be avoided, and were, I suppose, supported by some even governmental institutions here in Canada as well. So it's been about 130 years of trauma that has not been able to be recovered using our traditional methods. So, and this is really important when I'm going to be talking about health transformation. Health transformation is an idea from a tribal council here in Ontario that plans to integrate plant medicine, any plant medicine, doesn't have to be psychedelic, into the common Western model. Now, health transformation, it's really difficult for many traditional healers and people and practitioners who work with plant medicine in general to integrate into a Western style perspective, because nobody believes in many of the methodologies that we would have used in the past. But it's because of this underlying trauma that was instituted by, you know, our social systems here in Canada of the last 120, 150, 200 years. And so integrating this plant medicine has been a big part of what it is that I'm doing in many of these First Nation communities, and not in my own, because in my own community, there is quite a bit of trauma, and it's a little bit too close to home for me to be able to help in the best ways. So I have a little bit of separation, which is really helpful. In the community that I'm in right now, this is Kenora, Ontario, Canada, and it's has a beautiful Lake of the Woods. And in this area, there were maybe, I think, four or five residential schools where the children, the Indigenous children, were being re-educated to a Western model, and so that people can be reintegrated into a common system that the general government believes in, so that we can function in the economy, so that we can be hardworking peoples. But we left behind our traditions and our ways of being. So integrating this plant medicine into the Western models that are employed in many of these communities is very, very important for rediscovering and keeping our traditions intact. And even over the last 120 years, we lost a lot of our medicine traditions. We don't have psychedelics like ayahuasca. We have a few that we do use, and we still use tobacco in a sacred way. We call it Sama. But the pervading perspectives have limited our uses in general. So this has been a long-term problem. I'm not going to get into that, but the whole point is that there's a sense of hesitancy from the people and from the general population, from the government, to be able to integrate many of these medicines into a model that can be employed for everyone. So this is where I come in as a traditional healer, as well as I used phytochemical methods in my master's of ethnobotany, because I have to be able to explain how many of these compounds work in a body in a Western perspective. So I'm kind of like a bridge between worlds. And so because we don't have these psychedelics, the way in which people think we do, my teacher, Maestro Juan Flores, I got very sick at one point in my life, and I was looking for a real healer. And there are many healers in Canada here, and some that are very, very good, but I couldn't get in contact with many of them at the time of my need. And so I somehow found Maestro Juan Flores in the Peruvian Amazon. And in my very first ayahuasca experience, he came to my dream, the end of the dream. And he said, "You got to come to Peru. Everyone should come to Peru." And he's so special, because the only time I ever saw him, like an image of him, was in National Geographic France. I can't remember which edition it was, but He was at the River of Boiling Water, and that's where his healing center is. And it's a fabulous, miraculous place to be. And just to be there in general is very heartwarming. So I hope that one day that I could return. And even though I'm not there, I continue to study because I employ his methods that he taught me in the Amazon here in the boreal forest. Well, I have a mixed wood forest here. So boreal forest, Great Lakes, St. Lawrence tree region. So there's some deciduous trees and there's some evergreen kind of trees, conifers and things like that. And Maestro Juan Flores, he said he could help us. He said he could help the indigenous peoples of Canada. And I didn't understand at the time what he was completely saying, but he opened my mind, or he helped me to learn how to open my mind and my heart, mostly my heart, enough to be able to see all of these perspectives that I've just shared with everyone. I wasn't able to see many of that because, just like every other Indigenous person in Canada, I was stricken with trauma. And many of the methods that he used, like the dieta, the method of dieta, no salt, no sugar, no grease, no exciting foods, they changed my body in a very, very big way. And this is many of the foods that are given to us in the First Nation communities, they're completely processed. They're processed in a, and it's funny because when you go up to community, they call it white food. And they don't mean white food, they mean urban. Like there's a difference between urban peoples and rural peoples. So when we're given urban foods, we know that these urban foods lead to diabetes, lead to chronic illnesses, heart disease, periodontal disease, which is prevalent. So it's really, really important that we take time away from this food. So Maestro Juan Flores told me that when you're doing a dieta in the forest, in our forest, that you would eat the traditional food of the people, which is really interesting because when I've been in South America, we have very little meat, but we have all meat here. And we also have a thicker amount of adipose tissue, like brown fat, that protects us from the cold so that we can survive like minus 50 temperatures. And the Peruvian Amazon, you do not need to survive very, very cold temperatures. It's very, very warm, very sweaty, very hot. So it's a cleansing in and of itself to be at this specific place in the world. So Maestro Juan Flores considered or helped me to consider that we could use his methodologies, or, you know, the methodologies of the traditional peoples of South America, to be able to communicate with the plants and integrate bring our traditions back to ourselves, because this is what was lost in the last 120 years. We lost almost everything. You know, I was in the UK in 2019 at Breaking Convention, and there was a question from the audience that was... it was hard for me to answer because the question was to the peyote folk and to the ayahuasca folk and to the Ibogaine peoples, talking about, you know, the appropriation of many plant medicines. And I didn't know how to answer. The question was, you know, how is the appropriation of many of these medicines hindering the future of and the viability of many of these plants for future generations? And I told them, and maybe it was frightening, but it was frightening for me to say that we lost them a long, long time ago. Like there's many plant medicines that we use that we just do not talk about either. Like we do not share many of these teachings because we don't want them to be appropriated. But many of the compounds that are available or that are known to be psychoactive, they don't really exist where we are. There's very few. So there's one medicine called the Amanita muscaria formosa, and I can't remember, for any of you science buffs, I can't remember the new name for it, but it's a type of Amanita, and it has the muscimol, the ibotenic acid, and we have whole traditions with this specific medicine. But we don't use it the way in which you would use ayahuasca or ibogaine or psilocybin or anything like that. And so none of the laws really reflect, none of the laws have ever reflected integrating psychedelic medicine from an indigenous perspective. Many people ask me that, is how do we integrate this, or how do we use the indigenous people to bring legality to the Canadian markets? And it's like, it's non-existent. And even in my undergraduate degree, I'm an archaeologist as well, an anthropologist, and I've seen no evidence, very little evidence that would be able to support a Western perspective of integrating psychedelic medicines into the daily world. So really what I'm bringing is a new paradigm to the people, and it's been very effective. So many Indigenous peoples who have gone through very great, terrible traumas have gone through full month dietas with me and have experienced new ways of thinking and new ways of being and new connections to the land. And this is where we need to go first. Dr. Gabor Mate talks about how connection is like the cure. Connection is the cure to many addictions. So, and his words escape me right now, but I always hold it dear to me, some of his work that he's done in the Lower East Side of Vancouver with many of the people that are very sick there. And we have many people in my region that are just as ill, because the residential schools, the last one just closed in the 1990s, I think 1996. So the need is so great in my city. It's so great. And I know that the ayahuasca has helped the people. And many times I want to help everyone that I can, but it's so difficult when the word church, like if I legally got rights to make a vegetalista church, people don't like the word church because of the residential schools. So I'm kind of working in between the perspectives of the people, the Western perspective, and then my own knowledge that I've accumulated in the psychedelic world. So it's been a challenge, and I've been doing my best to just try to help as many people, even just little by little. That's what Maestro Juan Flores says, little by little. And I feel like I've been doing it little by little, but it's not enough. It's getting worse. We just found a mass grave in BC. 215 children were found just dumped from the 1960s. So this is not that far long ago. It's very contemporaneous.
That was Yasmin Pirochek, a consultant developing a traditional medicine strategy for the diabetes epidemic in the First Nations communities in Canada. She spoke recently at an event sponsored by the UK NGO Drug Science that was part of their series on women in psychedelic science. And that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Century of Lies. Find this edition of Century of Lies, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. The Drug Truth Network has a Facebook page. Please give it a like. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.